There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Weirdly enough, I mean, a lot of like devices do this, but the bottom left of my browser is telling me that there's been a wind warning just issued, right. Which is like a weather report. But I saw that and thought, oh goodness, how do they know that?
I know. It's sad. It's amazing what they can do these days, isn't it, really? They think of everything, don't they?
They think of everything, and we're fully informed throughout, which is good. But how have you been, Brian? You okay?
I've been very well, thank you, Chris. Yeah, you?
Yeah, very well, actually. Can't complain. We say this on most of the episodes, but we are moving now definitely dangerously towards Christmas periods, because on my Netflix waiting screen, there was The Grinch. The Grinch came up. But it was the animated one that Benedict Cumberbatch did the voice. I don't think you can top the Jim Carrey one, to be honest. I think
that's... Probably is. You know, they tend to set a certain standard, don't they? A certain films, and they set the standard that everyone else has to follow and match, particularly with a Christmas movie as well. You know, so yeah, I guess it probably is really the one with Jim Carrey. It's the one you always think of, and it's the American equivalent to Scrooge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very big over there than here, but I think we've sort of adopted it slightly. But before that is obviously Halloween. So, do you get in the mood for Halloween, Brian? Do you watch any scary films?
Well, not really. You know, I tend not to be affected by scary horror type movies. I do my best to be scared by them, but I'm not. It's not because I'm particularly brave, right? It's not that. It's just that I don't think my imagination rises to the occasion necessarily, and I just sort of sit there watching and think, yeah, that's okay. So I tend not to get that engrossed in it. I enjoy them, but they don't scare me. What about you?
Yeah, I'm the same. I think having looked at a lot of films over the years, that you can't see films the same way, and you're often watching them kind of going, oh, okay, that's how they've done that, and that's how they've done that. So you are constantly like picking them apart, that isn't the best environment to be watching a scary movie in. And then also I think there's different types of horror films generally, but the things that don't really appeal is like the really sort of like shocky ones, whether it's like, you know, Human Centipede, all that sort of stuff. Like, I'm not really into that sort of thing anyway. That I find that more just not boring, but it doesn't get me. And then to be honest, I get more out of like a thriller. Even not necessarily, I'm not scared by it, but I am maybe at least invested in how it's going to turn out.
A chiller, as opposed to horror.
Yeah, chiller. That's a good phrase. Yeah, chiller, where you are. So something like Seven, like David Fincher's Seven,
which is
a great film. Actually, that should be on our list, really. Mm. But it's something like Seven works really well because it is actually quite like scary and horrific at times, but you wouldn't think of it as an out and out horror. It's more of a thriller or a chiller. But I do need something. I need more substance to it. It has to have like a good plot, and it has to sort of work as a story. Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, you compare it to say Hammer Horror, for example. Now, that's you know, revered by horror fans, isn't it? But to me, it was almost like caricatures, and it kind of misses the point, really. What I would call a really great horror movie is something like The Wicker Man, the original.
The original, yeah, not the Nick Cage one.
Not the Nick Cage one, but the original with Edward Woodward. That was stunning, and that was genuinely scary. You know, you could sit there, even though I've seen it maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 times, but I still, my flesh creeps a little bit. I get goose pimples because of the way it's made. That is a true shocker. That is a true horror movie. But there are very few of those, in my opinion, there are very few of those that hit the marks, that don't try too hard, that don't branch out, go over into caricature, but they get it just right. And it's easy to overdo it.
I do think it's a genre, though, that it does appeal, because it can be done effectively, even with a small budget. So like something like Blair Witch, and a lot of these like found footage sort of films that are coming out, that it lends itself to that, because actually sometimes like the more low budget it looks, the more effective it is. Whereas you know, if you're trying to tell like a good action film, you can't really do that without some budget, or at least very good CGI. That I think sometimes that helps, is if you've got something that is aesthetically on point, because it doesn't, not saying that it needs lots of money, it just needs to have the right tone and the right vibe. And I often, there's so many horror films that get made, and
I think at times you can be too slick. I think when you've got a big budget, it becomes too smooth, too slick, and it again misses the point. I think it's very easy to overdo it, and if you've got a big budget, it's tempting, isn't it?
If you don't need to be as creative as you would have been, I think that does affect a lot of filmmakers, where they sort of, we've got money for that now. That, whereas actually before, they would have had to have done some kind of practical effect that would have taken them ages but cost like less money. Yeah. That at least they would have pulled it off and looked really good.
Good horror is about getting inside your head, and you don't need to spend a fortune to do that. It's about getting the viewer to use their imagination.
Well, you've given me a nice little segue there, because we're going to try and get in the listener's head now, and they don't need to pay a thing, because this podcast is free wherever you're listening. If someone is charging for this, they shouldn't be, and send them my way.
I was going to say, they should be paying us, and in that case, shouldn't they?
Exactly. Because we have a big show tonight. Mm. It is rather large, because we've been sent quite a lot of indie films to review. Thank you to all the filmmakers who are sending their movies. We even have a little queue ready for the next month, to be honest.
Nice.
So what we've done, and it has kind of tied in nicely, because Brian has very kindly watched some films at the cinema, but a few that you were planning on watching have now been, the release dates, I think, were moved anyway.
They're playing with us.
Toying with you. It's almost like knew, though.
I know.
Like, oh, well, Brian's not going to watch it, so. So we're going to do 3 at the cinema. We'll do a streaming film as well. Interesting film there. We've got 5 indie films to review on this show, and then we will finish it up with a classic film that we are revisiting in our nostalgia pick. I won't say what it is. Stay tuned for that. But first, let's get Equalizing.
Oh, I like it.
See what I did there?
I saw what you did there. Yeah. Okay, so this is directed by Antoine Fuqua, starring Denzel Washington and Dakota Fanning. It's the third installment of the franchise that began in 2014. Washington plays retired intelligence agent Robert McCall. Our hero has a dark past, but forges a new existence, protecting the innocent against the mad, bad and dangerous. A train of events take McCall to a small town in southern Italy, where he decides to settle. But old habits die hard, and he reports evidence of a criminal network to CIA operative Emma Collins. The Camorra soon come calling and begin to intimidate the locals, but they hadn't reckoned with McCall and the unique skill sets he can bring to the party. This is typical of a franchise, insofar all memory of the previous one disappears when you watch the current release, but gains more credibility because it has a strong leading man. Washington doesn't let the visuals do all the work, and builds a strong character that smacks of the world-weary agent who can't leave his old life behind. Amidst the slick design of violence, it's a coherent story that has the feel of a modern Western. The tale of a stranger in town, protecting the weak from the strong, is the template for many films in the genre, especially The Magnificent Seven. There are moments of genuine tension where McCall shows controlled aggression and a minimal use of dialogue to make his point. The bad guys have met their match and the audience are left in no doubt as to whose side they should be on. The Amalfi Coast of Italy provides a stunning backdrop and is the perfect location for a holiday. But if you do go, make sure McCall's close by. but very enjoyable overall.
Yeah, I've seen the first two and I liked them. I'm actually, this is a, because I've talked about Washington before, and pairing with Antoine Fuqua, I think, is great because things like Training Day. You mentioned Magnificent Seven there, actually. Is this up there with the first two installments? Does it work just as well?
Yeah, I think it is. I don't think you even necessarily need to see the first two movies. They're all standalone movies. Mm. But as I say, what's often the case with a franchise is that you do tend to forget what's gone in the past and you remember the current one. But I think it's easily matches up with the first two. You know, it's very efficient, very well done. And it gains because it's got Denzel Washington. You know, in the hands of a lesser actor, it wouldn't work as well because he makes the character work. And that's what makes all the difference. And there's something very cool and understated about McCall, the way he plays the character. You know, that again, coming back to the idea of a modern Western, it's almost a bit like Clint Eastwood, The Man with No Name, where he says very little. You know, he very rarely utters his own name, McCall, but you know exactly who he is and what he's there for, and you can't mess with him. And great fun to watch. And as I say, easily up with the first two, as good as the first two. The quality's not diminishing. So I'd be happy to see this franchise continue for a while longer.
It's interesting seeing lots of reviews, and a few people had said to me they like this film. That there's always this comparison as well with like the John Wick series, because I think obviously there is some similarities. I like both. I haven't seen this film, but I like both sets of movies, and I don't think there's like, you know, it's fine for them to do that. But there's that sort of sense of Washington's character's that kind of like reluctant hero again, where it's sort of being dragged into it and he goes through it. It feels quite familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, he wants a quiet life, you know. And you could also, I mean, you could pull out other characters from the movies. I mean, Don Vito Corleone in Godfather Part 3, where he says, just as I was getting out, they pulled me back in. But that's a common theme. And it's real. It kind of makes sense because somebody like McCall, right, will get to a point in his life where he thinks, I don't want to do this anymore. I just want to live in peace. But somebody who's lived that life, being the type of person they are, can never quite bury that side of their personality. And they're constantly drawn back in. So I think that is real. You know, that is real for somebody like McCall, for somebody who lives that life, they can't leave it behind.
Yeah.
So it's a very good film, though. I really enjoyed it.
Good. And it's perfect cinema fare, isn't it? You're going to watch a movie at this on the big screen, it's perfect. Yeah, so
definitely. It's well worth going to the cinema to see this one.
Yeah, if you're listening currently, as in you're not listening to this in the future, if you are in the future, hi. But if you're current, then this film is still at the cinema, so do go check it out. And no matter what Martin Scorsese says, it's okay to support franchises. You know, I know he's got a big thing with them. I know his thing's more about the superhero stuff, but I think he also has a bit of a problem with franchises. But it is because he's got a new film out, isn't it? He says it every time as he's got a new film out, and then he gets all of these headlines and he just sits back and watches the cash rolling.
I mean, in the past, I've been occasionally critical of franchises, as you know. But I do find them enjoyable as long as they maintain the standard and they're not simply rehashing what's gone before. That's the important thing with any sequel or any franchise, that they're refreshing the character. They're refreshing the idea. They're coming up with something new. That's the important thing, you know.
Well, it seems a good point to move from one franchise to another then with our next film, another Kenneth Branagh Poirot movie, Haunting in Venice.
Everyone who ever lived here falls victim to some tragedy. Like her daughter a year ago.
My daughter was my whole life. To hear her voice again, I would give all I have.
If someone wants to be heard, we are here.
Woman called
the spirits
and they answered.
You saw what I saw.
For once in your life, admit that you are up against something bigger than you.
Tonight we are all afraid. We cannot hide from our ghosts. Whether they are real or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then. So, obviously directed by Kenneth Branagh, starring Kenneth Branagh, Tina Fey, Jamie Dornan, and Michelle Yeoh. This is based on an Agatha Christie novel called Halloween Party. Only now the action moves away from leafy England to Venice, where Hercule Poirot lives in retirement. His friend and novelist, Ariadne Oliver, wants Poirot to attend a seance and observe Mrs. Reynolds, a medium with a certain reputation. Ariadne, for her part, is researching a new book and desperate for a hit. Poirot's intellect is aroused and duly attends. But it's not long before guests meet an unfortunate end. Poirot naturally is on hand to investigate. Now, I'm a big Agatha Christie fan. I love Agatha Christie. And I also like Kenneth Branagh's take on Hercule Poirot. It's fairly typical. What you see is what you get. It's beautifully shot and lovely to look at. But I think it really opens the debate as to who the best Poirot is. I think it's becoming a comparator to the best James Bond. Like, who's your favourite James Bond? Now we're going to say, who's your favourite Poirot? And I think Kenneth Branagh's up there. I don't know about you. I mean, are you a fan of Poirot?
I remember I've seen a couple of the newer ones with him. And then, was it David Suchet? Was he?
David Suchet played Poirot on the small screen.
Yeah, that's the only other one I know, I think.
Yeah, well, this is what I would say, that Kenneth Branagh is near the top of the tree. The only one that can top him, I think, is P.C. Ustinov, who played Poirot throughout the 70s and the 80s, I think. It's worth checking out those films, because he brings something quite unique to the role. Albert Finney did something similar with Murder on the Orient Express. And, of course, Kenneth Branagh remade that film as Hercule Poirot, but Kenneth Branagh is very good. You know, he adds something extra to the character. Agatha Christie, apparently, whenever somebody was cast to play Poirot, she was never satisfied. Even with Peter Ustinov, you know, they were either too fat, too thin, too tall, the moustache was wrong, you know. And I think, in some ways, Poirot, as played by Kenneth Branagh, is getting closer to what Agatha Christie imagined he would be. But to get back to the film itself, visually, it's stunning. It's great to look at. And it also borders on horror. You know, it dips its toe into the horror genre because, you know, it stems from a book by Agatha Christie that was Halloween Party. But they've kind of refined it and they've twisted it slightly and turned it into a different direction. But doesn't harm the story at all. And it's very good.
Because I watched the trailer for this and I also looked at some of the reviews and the poster and stuff, and it did have a very dark, like, horror kind of leaning to it. It felt like, because when you watch like Murder on the Orient Express, it feels a little bit kind of campy, to be honest. It's a bit sort of like, oh, like cheap and cheerful everyone's having a lovely time kind of thing. But with this, it did feel a bit more like, oh, okay, they're getting a bit dark here. Is that tone noticeable? Like, that's a different tone?
I think it is. You know, I think a lot of Agatha Christie stories are very tongue-in-cheek, and you know what you're getting. You know that all the suspects are going to be assembled in one place. They're going to be in the library, or they're going to be on a train carriage or somewhere. And you've got Hercule Poirot, who's very cleverly working everything out. This, again, as I say, it's kind of shifting it in another direction more, because this is, I wouldn't say it's scary, but it puts you on edge more. You don't feel quite as comfortable with it. It's just as enjoyable, but it's not a typical Poirot story. Not really. It's not a typical Agatha Christie story. But as I said, when you look at the book, if you read the book, it's different. It is different. But yeah, I think you're right. I think you've picked that point up well, that it is taking Poirot and Agatha Christie stories in a slightly darker direction. But that's no bad thing, because
no, I think it's good. Like, especially for, like you said, like franchises like Bond and stuff like that often they did the same thing, like with each film maybe changing the tone slightly. So it didn't just feel like another outing of the same character and the same thing. It was like, give, especially as well, someone like Branagh, you know, he's made so many films that he's going to want to be doing different things. He's not going to want to just be rehashing the same story. So it's good that, like I said, I was very surprised when I saw the trailer. I thought, oh, this actually fits in quite nicely with the October coming up. And
you're right.
A little scary movie to go see at the cinema.
But I really enjoyed it. I liked it. You know, I think possibly Agatha Christie is an acquired taste in some ways, but the skill with Agatha Christie is that it's misdirection, insofar that she will give you the solution very, very easily, and she'll snatch it back again, and she'll send you off in a different direction. And you see that in so many of her stories, where you had the solution, but she kind of gets you to look elsewhere. You know, makes you look at other characters. Oh, I think maybe it was so-and-so.
Yeah.
That's what's great about Agatha Christie. But I think, in the hands of Kenneth Branagh, I think the genre, the franchise is doing well, doing very well.
Here we go. I thought you were going to say in safe hands there. I thought he's going to say in safe hands. But
I thought about it. I thought about it, you know. But
I thought maybe you're not so sure about Branagh's hands, are you?
Look, you never know. I've not seen his hands. I mean, I'd say what you do see more of in Hercule Poirot films is his moustache. It's incredible.
It is a lot, isn't it? Even the films I've seen, I was like, they really made a point to make it stand out. And I thought, all power to him. I'm here for it. That's absolutely fine.
And he must grow that properly. That's not a false moustache. That is something he's grown, I'm sure it is. You couldn't possibly stick one of those on and get away with it, could you? You know? I don't think so, anyway. I never tried it myself, have you?
No, I'm quite lucky. I do grow facial hair quite easily, but I actually don't suit a moustache. I don't know many people who do, to be honest. So I've not partaken in it. But if I did have one, I'd like it to be like Poirot's. I think that is pretty
good. Okay, then. Fair enough.
Our next film lead character does not have a mustache. Is that a good enough segue? It's not great a segue, but it's a segue.
It's good enough. It'll do for now.
It's Paul Dano starring in the film Dumb Money.
Dumb Money, yeah. Okay then, Dumb Money. Directed by Craig Gillespie. Starring Paul Dano, Seth Rogen, Vincent D'Onofrio. I always get his name wrong. And Shailene Woodley. Based on a true story, this is about the little man standing up to the fat cats of Wall Street. Keith Gill is a financial advisor who plays the stock market. With a blog and a YouTube channel, he generates interest in an obscure company called GameStop. Soon, all and sundry are buying shares in the company, forcing their value through the roof. Panic spreads among hedge funds as tactical dealing is thrown into turmoil. Now, here's the thing about all stock markets. They rely on confidence. Small investors stick because they're confident the value would increase. They're millionaires, but only on paper. If they sell the share price will go through the floor as the market will be flooded with shares. It's all about supply and demand. But who will blink first? This is a bright and engaging film, but needs a fair amount of concentration. I'd recommend some light reading before you see it, or else you might get lost in the terminology. A short squeeze isn't quite what it sounds like. But really, unless you're familiar with the stock market, you might struggle. I only just about kept up with it myself. I had to dredge my memory of A-level economics. Cool, that was painful. But it's well worth the effort. You've got to be patient and stick with it. It's a thinking film, but very, very good.
I mean, I watched the trailer for this as well, and I was very intrigued. I love these sort of films. Yeah. The Big Short was a good film that was
out a few years ago.
A similar kind of tone, obviously.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You've got these, I think these sort of films often do well in times of economic crisis. Although I do wonder when are we not in economic crisis? Well, I feel like I always am. Particularly at the moment. So that when you've got these stories about, you know, your every man just suddenly being able to take on this crazy system and give it the big, you know, two fingers. I think that those films often do well, and a great cast. I was watching because I do like Paul Dano, and there's a few people in this film, like Shailene Woodley, she's great.
Yeah.
Vincent D'Onofrio. It's the sort of film that's like, oh yeah, definitely got to watch this, because these people wouldn't attach themselves to something that wasn't worth watching, you know?
No. I think it's very well cast. The actors really interact with each other really well. And you're right. It is a story about, it's David and Goliath. It, you know, that's where the title of the film comes from, Dumb Money. That's what they call small investors. All the fat cats on Wall Street and possibly on our stock exchange as well. They were called small investors. That's dumb money. They're putting money into a company that's not worth anything. But what's fascinating about this film really is how somebody like Gil, Keith Gil, is that he's an ordinary guy who's getting people to take notice of what he's doing, and people gain confidence in him because he's buying money in this company, and that share value is going up, and it's disturbing the equilibrium, right? Because the big guys, the fat cats, have got it all their own way. They can do what they like. They can manipulate the market, do exactly what they want. But here's someone who's just an ordinary guy out in the street. He's managing to take them on. And it's a true story as well. That makes it even better in my book. It's a true story. It actually happened. So I think it's one to mark for your attention, because it is that kind of film. But you have to, as I say, you have to concentrate on it. You know, but it's very good, very enjoyable.
I think when they have films about money and, you know, investing and things like Wolf of Wall Street, we mentioned The Big Short, stuff like that, where it's a bit like sometimes they do have to kind of, I don't know, explain it in layman's terms, because otherwise it would just be like, what? Sorry, what? Yeah. Like, you know, you're not going to enjoy it if you can't understand it.
But that's why I would say, just have a look, have a read up of what actually happened. Not too much, just sort of read up on what the story is basically about and how a stock market works, because otherwise you might get lost. I mean, I'm not saying we're not capable of understanding what's going on. I mean, the principle is buying and selling when all's said and done, right? It's a bit like playing poker, right? So there are kind of touch points within the film that we all relate to, but it helps. It aids your appreciation of what's going on if you just know a little bit about it before you watch it.
Well, thank you, Brian, for the cinema reviews. Mm. So all three films are currently available to see in cinemas. Mm. And yeah, we recommend you see them all, because
they're all
good crop there, actually, Brian.
I know. Did well this time. Did well. Yeah.
We're moving on now, and this could be another film whereby some pre-reading would be worthwhile, because I knew nothing about this subject, if I'm honest, is El Conde, the new film on Netflix from Pablo Larraín. And it's all about Augusto Pinochet. Mm. Did you know much about Chilean history, Brian?
A fair bit. Well, I wouldn't say an awful lot. But, you know, when I was growing up, I kind of half remember the Pinochet regime. I was very young at the time. I might have been 8 or 9. And Pinochet took power. And I also recall a film about the Pinochet years in Chile. It's a film called Missing, with David Shea and Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek. If you can find it, it is a fantastic film.
That's a good cast.
Yeah. And it's true, again, another true story, folks, but it was based on the Pinochet years. And Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek were a father and daughter trying to find the son-in-law, played by David Shea, who went missing in Chile. And that was probably early 80s. And so I know a reasonable amount about Chile, but I understand why it could be a blind spot for a lot of people, because it is, we're talking the best part of 50 years ago when he was a name, so to speak, you know. So yeah, but I think some reading is probably is necessary here.
Because with this, so El Conde is a black comedy take on it. It's cross hybrid. It's like a hybrid with a vampire story.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's obviously not a. It's certainly not a documentary. No, but it's playing on this idea of the character, but then throwing it into a whole different idea that actually he was born in the French Revolution, became a vampire then, has lived for centuries, and then became this terrible dictator who is now living his sort of final years, doesn't want to carry on, wants to give it all up and die, but has the issue of giving away his money and things to his kids, who are all like sponges. Is that the right word?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good expression.
Being
really
nice, I think. Yeah. But the accountant who comes over to sort of oversee all this is from a kind of religious background, and actually maybe she's trying to kill the vampire as well.
Yeah.
I would say it's a film that, if you go into this completely blind, is incredibly confusing.
Yeah.
It's all over the place. And I think that, you know, like I said, the background on Chile is needed. I think you need to have at least a good understanding of what the character was meant to be in order to appreciate what they're doing here. Because I felt like a lot of it was going over my head.
Yeah.
How did you feel about it?
I quite liked it. It's an inspired idea, though, isn't it? The idea that you can take a South American dictator like Pinochet and make him a flying vampire. I thought, yeah, okay, it kind of, you know, it's so weird. I mean, that's the word that screams at you all the way through this. It's weird.
It is very weird, yeah.
Because at one point, Carmen Sita, who's the accountant or the religious lady who tries to do an exorcism, she ends up interviewing members of the family, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And which I think is kind of, in some ways, becomes a cross-examination of the Pinochet years and how they gain from the patriarch's dirty deeds. But that's not immediately obvious. So it's kind of throwing lots of different ideas at you. And a real curveball for me was Margaret Thatcher appearing at the end. I thought, hang on. Hi, hang on.
I knew you were going to say that. I was the same. I was like, what?
Hang what on a minute. But so, as I say, I liked its quirkiness. Its weirdness really appealed to me. But you're right, though, that if you don't have any appreciation of Pinochet and what he did, it won't make even the slightest bit of sense.
Because it's obviously, it's being ironic. There's lots of irony in here. And like you say, she's interviewing the family members, that if you didn't connect the fact that what she was talking about were actual real events that were horrific and barbaric, that the power of that is completely lost on the audience, because they don't understand why that is so deep. I did really, because I did have some vague understanding of who Pinochet was, but certainly not in any kind of great detail. So I got the idea of the film, so I went in at least knowing, okay, yeah, this is like a send up, but it's like a hybrid. But I still feel that had I known more about what was going on, that I would have got more out of it.
I think that's true.
In terms of the actual film making, it's incredible. There's lots of really, really impressive sequences. I love the flying. I thought the flying was really powerful.
I know.
Great.
The cinematography, the way it's shot, is fantastic.
Yeah, I should say as well, it's black and white, the whole
black
film,
and white,
and it is presented in the original Spanish language. I, halfway through, switched to the English. You can change the audio.
Yeah.
The reason for that was, I typically never do that. The reason was, it was so fast talking, I could not read the subtitles fast enough. It was just impossible to keep up, that I was like, do you know, I'm going to have to watch it in English, because I'm not getting this enough. I was spending so much time focusing on the subtitles that I wasn't actually watching it. And like I said, I don't normally do that, but I did have to for this one.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I struggle with subtitles. I've got better at reading subtitles in recent years, but I don't know whether it's laziness on my part, that the fact that you know, that you're kind of reading the bottom of the screen and trying to watch what's going on. And I find that distracting.
My wife doesn't like it. She can't do it. She's the same. She's like, it's distracting. But for me, I grew up with, we always put them, I don't need them. We just always had them on for some reason. I just grew up watching them with them. So I'm kind of used to it. But with this, I struggled.
Yeah. I suppose the alternative to that, though, with a foreign language film is to see something dubbed. And I think that's kind of variable, really. I mean, you obviously get what's going on precisely, but I mean, unless you speak that language, you're not going to appreciate exactly what's being said, right? And when it is translated into English, something is always lost.
That is what is interesting as well, is sometimes you switch over, right? So you've got, originates in Spanish and you've got the subtitles, which is the English version of what they're saying, but then the dubbed audio doesn't match up with the English subtitles. It's really strange, because it's like it wouldn't make sense to say those things. So it was, like I said, that may have impacted my enjoyment slightly of the latter half of the film, but I got to the point where I was like, nope, I'm focusing so much on reading. I'm not actually absorbing the film, because there were so many really great bits to the film. It does have that, like I say, weird is definitely the first word that comes to mind, but there's also like, there's a dark comedy. It's got lots of these, they're bits that are funny, there's bits that are really kind of, they do get you. But largely, I found it, I'd say, kind of disturbing, but in a kind of frenetic way, because there was so much going on. There's a lot of characters, a lot of the children are all like plotting and scheming at the same time. There was a lot going on, like they're blending up hearts because he's trying to like revive himself and stuff. So there was a bit of a horror element. There was lots of pensive cello music being used throughout as well to create this like weird tone that I don't know, for me, I just feel that I don't think I could appreciate it on a level that I needed to, but I understood that it was a well-made film, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. No question it's well-made. I'd be interested to know what the reaction to this film was in Chile, because it's a Chilean film. Because this is dealing with a very dark period in that country's history, where I wouldn't mind betting that every family was affected by the Pinochet regime in some way. And I'd be fascinated to learn what the public reaction was in Chile when this went out, when it was first broadcast over there, because it, as I say, it's dealing with something that must be very painful for that nation to actually relive what happened back then.
Well, let me check to see if we have any Chilean listeners to the podcast.
That's an idea.
You never know. If you're a Chilean listener, obviously. This would be if you're based in Chile, but also maybe you're not based in Chile, but you are Chilean, in fact. Do get in touch and let us know what you thought. But let's just have a look, because you never know. Maybe we've got some. Someone there.
Put it out there. Let's see what happens.
Spain. Colombia. We've got some South America. So Chile. 11 listeners in fantastic. Chile. So of those 11, please get in touch. Tell us what you thought of El Pondo.
Absolutely.
We are clearly not up to the task, you know, compared to people that have lived in the country of origin. So, it'd be great to hear from you. And that was the original point of this show, UK Film Club, was to have people contribute. So do send in your reviews and let us know what you thought. Also, feel free to do that as well if you're not Chilean. I don't think we should make a prerequisite for every review.
Don't restrict it that much, you know.
Okay. So that was your streaming pick, guys and gals, and everyone in between for this month, which is available on Netflix, and it came out sort of the latter half of September, so it should be on there for a while. So you've got no excuse not to at least check it out. But I have stated, I think Brian agrees, a little bit of pre-reading wouldn't go amiss.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's move on now to our short and indie films. These are films that filmmakers have specifically sent us and asked us to review, so we are obliged to, and we will be as honest and as respectable as possible, because we want to make sure that these films get a fair reviewing. Some of these will have been reviewed on the website, some may not have been, but what we do here is just to shine a light on films that should be able to stand toe-to-toe with all the other films that we review. And we're going to start with a short film from filmmaker Liam Treacy called The Interview.
Tell me, Mr. Harrington, Why do you want to work for Duncan James & Associates, the most notorious criminal law firm in the world?
Well, I've always had a passion for fighting the good fight, standing up for the little man, and making sure that the worst people in the world are out there walking the streets. I know your firm has a history of representing some of the most reprehensible people in recent memory, and I'd like to put my experience defending murderers, rapists, and pedophiles to good use.
Do you really think you're going to impress them with answers like that?
Well, if you have something better, I'm all ears. Oh, wait. Okay, go.
This is it's a really interesting film. Yeah. Kind of, and actually, I put it here because similarly to El Conde, it's like it's slightly dark. It's got this kind of dark, ironic comedy sort of feel to it. And it was a bit, you didn't quite know what to think of it because the setup is that this lawyer at the beginning, and he's talking on the phone, and he's being like kind of classic lawyer, bit brutal, and then we find out he's talking to his mum.
I love that, which was great.
I thought that I did not see that coming. A guy sits in front of him and starts asking him questions, a lot of questions, as if he's in an interview, and that's like the name of the film. But all's not quite as it seems. There's something kind of a bit off about this scenario. The main lawyer, the sort of more, albeit looking successful lawyer, kind of ignores this guy for quite a while, just keeps looking at his phone, but then does react at some point. I'm reticent to give away the ending because I think the ending's worth the sort of twist.
Yeah.
But what do you think of the interview, Brian?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
It's good,
isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as you say, I don't feel we can say too much because it kind of gives away the beauty of this film, because I think in some ways it's portraying a situation we've all been in, because there's two men sitting in the same room. They're both allegedly, or by the look of it to me, what I got from it was they're both going to be interviewed for the same job. They're both lawyers. One's really hot shot. The other one's a bit of a mess, isn't he, with his shirt hanging out and all the rest of it, right? And you're sitting in the same room with another candidate. We've all done that, haven't we? We've all sat in the same room with a candidate for a job that we're being interviewed for. And it's a bit like, oh, what do you say? Do you make conversation? Do you try and pick up hints? What do you think they're thinking? All that type of thing. But of course, it's in a completely different environment. It's in a very elite field, isn't it? This firm of lawyers seem to specialise in getting crooks off the hook. You know?
The law firm is like knowingly representing bad people, and that's where like he's like guiding his answers towards being like, yes, I will do all of these like reprehensible things for your firm, and that's why you should hire me.
Yeah. So, you know, I like that kind of that interplay between the two of them is really good. But I think it's great. I really enjoyed it. You know, it's not often when a short film surprises you, genuinely surprises you. But this does, because you don't really know where it's going. I mean, as far as I could see, you just got two men sitting in the same room, waiting to be interviewed for the same job. That's it. That's where it puts you. But where's it going to take you? That's what's great.
The setup kind of works because they've done it very simply. In one room, there's no other locations, and there's not much wizardry going on. I think there's one point where the camera turns around, which actually was a bit jerky to be honest, but generally it's quite good. Lots of close framing of like the guy asking all the questions and stuff, and it really puts you into this intimate moment between these two people who are apparently strangers, that you then are given obviously very deplorable characters, really, or at least what they're talking about is quite nasty. You can't help but be gripped into what they're talking about and what's going on and how they found themselves in the situation. And I love that sometimes with short films, because they throw you into this, what is essentially could be a scene from a much bigger film that you're like just going, you're finding like, where am I? What's going on? Yep. Who am I meant to be rooting for? I love that. They did well to keep that sense of mystery around what was going on, whilst also, you know, going into stuff about, you know, greed and power and law and money and all this sort of stuff. I think it explored all those things really well, but it was a film that managed to know where the strengths of short filmmaking are. I really enjoyed it.
I mean, the morality is very clear there, though, isn't it? Because any professional, whether it's a law firm, an accountancy firm, is that eternal dilemma they have that, do you know, how concerned should we be about our clients? How much should we care about them? Should we be worried whether they're guilty, innocent, or indifferent? Right? Does that alter us representing them? They're entitled to a fair trial. If we can get an acquittal, happy days. But what morals are at play there? And that's what I was getting from that. And that's not easy to put across in a limited time frame, which is what we've always said about short films, that you've got so little time to introduce the characters, set up the plot, what's the premise, where's it going to go, where's the punch, where's the punchline, what's it going to leave you with? And we've only got about 10 minutes. Sometimes it's even less than that, with the opening and closing titles taking off. Yeah, you know, you're not talking about that many scenes, but they do it so well in this particular short. I'm really impressed with it.
Very good. To find a short film called The Interview may be difficult online because there are quite a few with this name. So I was finding information about the film. I sort of struggled. So the director and the writer's name is Liam Treacy, which is Treacy, and it stars Michael Lake and Thane Wesley. So just to give you any kind of tips on finding more about the film, I don't believe it's out yet because the link we were sent was a password protected link, and you can find Liam on Instagram. So it's Liam Adam Treacy, all one word after Instagram. So yeah, do keep an eye on it, especially follow the filmmaker, because often obviously they're be promoting the movie and let you know when it's available. I really enjoyed it, and obviously Brian has been singing praises too. And it's a really good example of what can be done with a short film. You know, we were talking earlier about horror films and you know, how they can make a lot out of not that much budget, and I think with this film it does a lot with very simple ingredients. So congrats.
Absolutely.
The Interview. We are heading to Ireland now, Northern Ireland, with a feature film from writer-director Danny Patrick called Pulcinella.
Are you all right?
Me? I'm fine.
Well, the truth's going to come out sooner or later. I mean, you won't be able to hide that belly for long.
I don't know what you're up to.
If we went to England, no one would find out.
I was wondering, Miss, what's England like?
England.
A friend of mine has gotten herself into trouble and needs to go there.
An abortion. What happened to that smart and sensible?
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Poor girl that I was talking to months ago.
I mean, we've been friends our whole lives, and I'm upset that you haven't discussed this with me.
How long do you think it'll take your mother to work it out?
She hasn't known, does she?
How was your summer?
I'm just boring. So boring you wouldn't believe, you know, like super boring.
Don't start with any lies.
It's not totally impossible to have a baby and go to college.
You're not given to coincidence, Father.
An open mind may help you find the messages you need.
Pulcinella was a ballet, wasn't it, Brian?
As far as I know, it is an obscure ballet, but that doesn't make me much the wiser if someone tells me it's obscure, because most ballets are obscure to me. But yeah, a ballet.
It's also pretty misleading to have even mentioned it with this review, because this film is not a ballet at all. It's got more in common with a film like Juno, to be honest. We see a girl, teenage girl, and it's based in Northern Ireland, close to Catholic school, but she is pregnant. And the whole film centers around her kind of coming to terms with that, whilst they're also putting on this school show of the same name, and how she's going to deal with it. She lives with her single mother, as well as her nan, but obviously where they live, pregnancy and abortion is obviously the very heavy topic in terms of what she can do. And she plans on leaving and go to England to maybe get an abortion. So yeah, it's a heavy film, but it's not done heavily. I found that actually it was very accessible. It was a lighter film than I was expecting, and great performances and just generally all around good. But what did you think of Pulcinella, Brian?
I really, really liked it. This is quality. It's real quality. It's well acted. And like most good dramas, it has pockets of humour woven into the dialogue. That it is dealing with a very heavy subject, particularly where it's located in Northern Ireland. And it brings to light the issues that women experience when they contemplate termination and pregnancy, where they have to leave the country, or they... You know, the law is changing there now, but I mean, it shows you the dilemmas they're in when it happens. Not only is Anya a schoolgirl, is pregnant, but she's Catholic, living in Northern Ireland, Portrush, a country with very strict abortion laws. So it brings that side of the story to the fore. But it's just so well acted. It's beautifully acted. The only thing I don't get about it is that Jamie Winston gets top billing in this film, and she's not in it that much, really. She's the drama teacher.
I was trying to work out who she was. Yeah, she's the drama teacher, isn't she?
Drama teacher.
Important character, but she's certainly not even top three.
Very good. Very good in the role, but I'm surprised she got top billing, because the stars of this film are Neve James, who plays Anya, and Todd Bell, who plays Leo, her best friend.
Yeah.
They're the two stars. They were all great, but... You know, I think it's a shame that they didn't get on top billing, because they should have done, because I think they were so good. What you've also got with this film, though, is some very interesting subplots going on as well, because Leo's brother, the one who's covered in all the tattoos, is kind of on the fringes of criminality, shall we say. And Leo kind of inadvertently gets sucked into it all. But I love the interplay between Leo and Anya, where they're not, you know, you think they're boyfriend and girlfriend, but they're not. They're best friends. And they're both appearing in the play. He's trying to swing a much bigger part because he wants to get to kiss the girl that's playing opposite him. And I love all of that. It's just that kind of teenage angst, the angst of puberty, you know, is all coming through there. And I love that kind of really human story. Great storytelling. Brilliant. That's how you act. That's how you get a message across. It's a lovely film.
And it is obviously the abortion side and the pregnancy side, but there's also the aspect that she's having these dreams about suicide as well.
That's
thrown in there. And we're talking about these things, but it never feels so heavy that you don't want to keep watching it. It actually feels a lot lighter than I think we're describing it. And I think that is largely due to this balance that the filmmaker has sort of captured of being, okay, yes, this is heavy and there is drama here and there's lots and lots of sequences which are affecting, but on the other side of it, there's also lots of merriment and whimsicalness and silliness. And I think, you know, this character is a teenager and her best friend's a teenager, and they have to go through those sort of things together too. I think the yeah, the chemistry between her and Leo, I think, was the, for me, the standout. I was like, yeah, I could watch these two characters do whatever, yeah, whatever's next. You know, maybe Leo needs a storyline next year. I'd happily just carry on with them.
Yeah,
great locations. It's sort of got sort of by the sea bits. Yeah, the subplot. I wasn't sure about the subplot of this sort of, because they're trying to rob a card game, and I was and also Anya's mum has a situation where she sort of loses her job, and they then bring this.
That's
boss.
Right.
He kind of comes into it, but I wasn't sure that was really necessary. I think it almost felt a little bit to me like they thought, oh, let's make sure people don't get bored or get too bogged down with the heavy stuff. Let's throw in these other, but actually you didn't need that because the characters were rounded enough for that. But it was still fine. It was kind of more adding to the eccentricity of the area, I guess, where you've got a bit more going on.
I think you're right. I never thought of that actually, where they put in that kind of subplot, which I mean, I liked it, but it is kind of a bit like you say, it's a kind of a way of putting a bit of action in to say, right, we don't want it to be too talky. We don't want it to be too, you know, thought provoking. You know, we don't want people to think too much on something that's a serious matter, you know? So yeah, it could be that could be going on there as well.
It could even be, you know, maybe there's some, I haven't actually looked into Pulcinella in terms of the story. Maybe there's some lines from there that are being drawn, but I just found that stuff a bit distracting. Mm-hmm. I did like knowing more about Leo's home life. I thought that was important, but to have dedicated so much time to it and also to actually give a lot of screen time in the final third to it, I was like, okay, you are really making a lot of this, whereas actually what we really care about is Anya and her situation and what she's going to do.
But otherwise though, it's a lovely film. It really deserves the highest praise, because you know, we always talk about great storytelling, don't we, and that's what it's doing.
Absolutely. And Pulcinella is due for a release at the end of October 2023, if you're listening to this now, if you're listening to it in the future, again, hi. But yeah, directed and written by Danny Patrick. So do look it out. And yeah, it's a fascinating film. Mm. It's got a lot of strengths. So yeah, fantastic. Mm. Sticking with the indie features, we now move to Darren Bender's indie film Ferryman, which he co-wrote with Darren Paul Fisher.
I was just fishing for how you two met each other.
I don't think she'd like me to tell you.
We should get married.
She joined a club.
This is the last time we talk about it.
We had a mutual friend. We advise all club members limit conversation with their ferryman to departure instructions only.
Yeah, surely you can get sent to jail for that. I mean, that must be illegal.
So you have to be a ferryman to get a ferryman.
I'm stronger than you think.
This, again, we're dealing with some heavy themes. Apologies we didn't put a trigger warning out at the beginning, but some of the things we're talking about are very heavy, and this film is no exception, because we have a character who was an ex-soldier who's trying to find his way again, goes to see his old sergeant, who was injured during combat and is now in a wheelchair. Mm. But we discover that the sergeant ends his life using the help of this ferryman system, which is essentially a community of people who are also looking to end their own lives, and they use each other for support to do so, using a text-based system, which basically is that you help someone end their life and then you can get someone to help you end yours. Not in a sort of murdery sense, but more in a sense of that they'll be there just to make sure that it all kind of goes off that hitch and you don't end up in a hospital bed somewhere or in a police station. So then our central character chases after the ferry woman, I should say, and of his sergeant, but sort of starts to piece together maybe quite sort of what's going on, but then he also falls for her.
Yeah.
And finds out more about her situation, because you know, why is it that she's part of this group? Why is she ending her life? And spoilers, I'm going to put that there because I feel like I've given quite a lot away, but she has a some kind of disease that basically means she's going to die soon. So the film then becomes a bit more about her life, her last days, spending them with our young soldier, and him coming to terms with the idea that she isn't going to be around. Eve, her name is, and his name's Ash. Yeah. So I think that was a very messy way of describing the film, but it kind of captured most of the points, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, there's no other way of describing it, because, you know, we can always be very conscious of spoilers, right? And we try and sort of give the listeners enough information to make a decision about the film and think, right, what's this going to be like? But with a film like Ferryman, you have to put that detail in, because you can't sort of be sparing about the detail. You know, you have to go in into deeper into the characters to really understand what it's about. Otherwise, you know, you'll be none the wiser if you're reading a review of this film or if you're listening to us talking about it. So you had to describe it in that way, really. This is dealing with some very tough themes, very difficult issues. Terminal illness, euthanasia, mental health. It's a lot to process, but it's very well written. Well acted, but it is relentlessly depressing. No, but it is.
You won't want to put that on the poster, though, would you? Relentlessly depressing.
Yeah, I know. But you see, the thing is, possibly some people wouldn't be bothered about that. But, you know, it does have moments of, like, relief. I mean, for example, when they were mucking about with the wheelie bin in the...
Is the point I've highlighted next. Yeah, the wheelie bin in the car park.
In the car park. Wasn't that great? Because, and they had a classical piece of music. Was it a Viennese waltz? It's a piece of classical music that you recognise, but you couldn't say who it's by. But that was a beautiful scene, and it was so important to break the tension in the way that it did. And I love that. I love that scene. I thought it was great.
And I think that is the crux of this film is, and it also ties into how much I think you'd enjoy it, is how much you buy into this blossoming new love, because like you say, a lot of the stuff in the film is dealing with heavy stuff and, you know, quote depressing stuff, that you then have a love story in tandem with it, that you've got the light and the dark happening at the same time, because, you know, there's bits of where they're having their romance, this blossoming romance, which are absolutely beautiful, it's lovely, it's a really, like, joyful experience, but then on the right underneath it is this terrible storyline that she's trying to kill herself, just helped someone else kill themselves, and then he also is suffering clearly with PTSD and lots of stuff you know, from his past, that it's a mix. But for me, I bought it enough that I did think, yes, I'm enjoying their relationship. I understand that maybe they've come together quick, but both of them are in a place in their life where that would happen, because she's in need of this sort of, like, you know, final experience of life, and he's in this situation where he doesn't know what to do with the rest of his life. And I think that them coming together felt kind of like fate, really.
I think also that the one positive note in the film, really, is about living for the moment, isn't it? It's about enjoying what you have here and now.
Yeah.
Right. And that's probably the most positive side that comes through, is that, you know, tomorrow will take care of itself. Live for today. Live for the moment. That's especially for the case for Eve, the situation she's in. But it's a message that everyone can draw in, isn't it? You know, so I think there's that side of it as well. But, you know, it is good. It is good. But it's a tough watch. At times, it's a very tough watch.
Yeah, I think so. Like with Pulcinella, which you just reviewed, I think it's a lot lighter with what it's doing. Whereas with this, I think it does get really into the thick of the dark stuff, and you are dealing with a lot, and it's a bit more actiony. There's a bit more tension being presented, I think, for the viewer, that it's not the same kind of experience, and also you're going to kind of go through it and feel a lot. I think you're being asked a lot as well. Like, for example, there's a bit where I must look up the name of the main character, Ash, that he intervenes in a certain situation and goes when Eve was meant to be there. And I'm like, what he does is like, that's a very strong action that you know, for what he was meant to be doing. That I think you do have to kind of suspend a bit of disbelief in terms of the actions of what's going on.
Yeah.
But it is a very you know, unique in because also with the film, yeah, the whole ferryman system, this whole tech system, that in itself is a whole film easily, like maybe more.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah.
And then, but then you've got this like romance and euthanasia and situation between Eve and Ash that is also its own film. It felt like there was that film Me Before You, which was based on a book, that it felt like that film was being put into this other like thriller.
I know
it's a lot. I think that the filmmakers really have sort of thought, do you know what, we're gonna make a big film here, this is huge.
I know.
And it does it all within an hour and a half. It's not like a long film. And hats off to the filmmakers, because it was ambitious. It's massively ambitious, and I totally bought into it. I was really engaged in it throughout. It was not boring at all. I just think that you do have to kind of take a lot in at once and go, oh, okay, but it was very, very ambitious. So that's the word I would use for this one, definitely.
And I watched it all the way through. What I often do with films is that I do break them up a little bit, particularly if I'm watching them online. It's very easy to do. But this film, I watched all the way through.
Yeah, I did too. I did with all of these. Yeah. Even El Conde, which I thought actually I was going to have to not. But I watched this all the way through, and I think you do need to stay in the moment. I don't think it would be a film that would benefit from breaking it up at all.
It breaks the tension, doesn't it? Yeah. If you do. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
But also just shout out to the music in the film, because it's got this really nice acoustic music throughout. And
I really
enjoyed that.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
There was one bit though, and I've put this in my notes as the last note, because it's a little bit of a sort of just a personal thing. But there's a bit where she's roasting marshmallows on top of a toaster.
I
found that so stressful to watch.
I know.
Like, you can't do that. You're going to ruin that toaster. That's a hazard. That's such a hazard. Come on. I know you like looking at dying, but not from a marshmallow on a toaster.
Health and safety, you know. It's not on. It's not happening, is it, really? Well, it is happening.
It did also make me very hungry. I was like, I could go for some of that.
That's right.
But Ferryman, as I said, directed by Darren Bender. It's currently, I believe, available to watch on Prime Video, according to its IMDb page. Yeah, and
good stuff.
Yeah, I definitely recommend people seek it out. I've been very impressed with it. It sounds like Brian has too. So
definitely
go and check out. Just see if there's any other. There is a Facebook page, Ferryman Movie, and there's Instagram, ferryman.film. So you've got no excuse not to check it out.
No.
Even our 11 Chilean listeners, come on. Go and
watch. So, I'm really impressed by that. We've got 11 Chilean listeners.
Yeah.
Really impressed.
Let's see what else. We've got one Guatemalan listener. If you are our Guatemalan listener, please get in touch. Because that is fabulous. Moving on now to another indie feature film, directed by Peace Osigbe, Golden Stripes.
Who are all of these people?
They're my ancestors, my inspiration. I want to make a difference in life. The world's so messed up. I just want to leave it in a better place then.
Said he couldn't protect me if I told anyone. If it's normal, what's he protecting me from?
You don't know about surviving, man. My whole life's a struggle, bro.
If he was as great as everyone made him out to be, he wouldn't have got himself killed.
They've been linked to a string of crimes against young women, but none of them have ever been charged.
Shut up! Please!
You should have pushed hard.
I need you to watch it.
With every fibre in my body, I will not fail to find out who did this to you.
Where is he?
Now, this, again, the word ambitious comes to mind.
It
was trying to take on a lot of heavy themes, this film. So we're presented with a character early on called Tyrone. And the very first scene, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but is that he experiences some issues with a priest. Did that happen?
Yeah, no, that was the very first scene, wasn't
it? Yeah, yeah. So we understand that, I think it's giving context that Tyrone has had a very bad childhood, but it isn't actually something they come back to, as far as I'm aware. Yeah.
No.
So we later see him as an adult, or sort of maybe late teenager, and he's trying to sell his art. He's been to lots of local galleries, and his art is essentially a lot of people who've influenced him and people who he finds to be powerful. But a lot of the galleries won't buy it, thinking it's going to spark too much tension. And so he feels very sort of despondent about that. There's also the same time, there's a spate of, there's a gang going around committing horrific sexual assaults and violence against people, which he happens to witness. And spoilers, he then is tracked down by the gang and they kill him. The film then becomes about the reaction to his death. We're still given flashbacks to him and who he was and things like that, but it's also about, you know, like his girlfriend and his mom and people like that trying to campaign for justice, because it just seems like another thing that the police don't really care about, and they aren't really making much of an effort to solve it. There's a local news channel involved, and they're trying to sort of bring it to the front. But Golden Stripes, Brian, what do you think?
I thought it was a brave effort to distill a number of complex issues, but I feel the narrative gets a little bit lost. Let me just unpack that a little bit. Tyrone, the central character, is attacked, but then it jumps to a demonstration where people are chanting justice for Tyrone. But we see nothing of the investigation that obviously failed to deliver justice. And the audience should see what went wrong. Otherwise, the story, for me at least, lacks symmetry. And that's what's happened here, that we're not seeing the other side of the story. We're only seeing one side of the story, that, you know, he didn't get justice. But why didn't he get justice? What were the, you know, what failed? What went wrong? And that's what I think we're missing here. And it makes the plot slightly lopsided, you know. But, you know, it is ambitious. I think that's probably the one word I'd use to sum it up. It's the word that you introduced it with, ambitious. It was an ambitious attempt to, as I said earlier on, to distill so many different issues and bring them all together, that I think it kind of didn't focus enough to make the story complete. Aside from that, you know, I like the locations. It was filmed in Dagenham.
I was watching this and I thought I saw some buses go around. And I thought, I bet Brian's loving this. I bet he knows exactly what bus that is and where they're going.
That's the thing. You know, of course, the story could be set in any city. This could happen in any city in the country. We know that. But that kind of gives it more authenticity for me. When you see places that you recognise, that's all good. But for me, I think the narrative needed to be a bit clearer and a bit more balanced. You know,
I do think it was disjointed. Like I said, that's why I brought up the priest bit at the beginning, because I thought that was going to be an actual part that we were going to be revisiting, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was just giving context that he came from a very bad background. Then we're given this idea about him becoming an artist. And we think, we're following that. Then he gets killed. And you're like, right. So we're then switching our point of view to different characters, and there's lots of scenes and lots of things, you know, different people who are sort of talking and getting involved. I found it also, even though they were doing all that, there's lots and lots of like plots and subplots going on, that some of the scenes were just so overly long. It was almost like they sort of gone, look, we've written this script, so let's film the whole thing and let's put the whole thing in. Like there's a bit where his sister, who's like, she's investigating, right? So she's a journalist. That she goes to a party at some point, and she's saying hello to everyone, and they kept it all in the film. She's just going around the room and saying hello to everyone. I was like, this does not need to be here at all. They just needed one like establishing shot of her going into the party, but that was it. But they kept the whole thing in, and I thought, oh, it might be maybe they knew all these people and thought, oh, look, we'll put you in the film.
We'll give you a credit. I think the editing could have been a bit sharper, possibly.
Because it's long as well. It's like almost 2 hours, right?
Yeah.
Which, and I don't think it's not strong enough to support that.
I think 2 hours is, for what was, for what they shot and what they showed, 2 hours is a long time. So whilst it has its moments and it has potential, but it just didn't give me enough of the story for me, purely as a viewer. We didn't see enough, so it kind of lost something for me, but it was a good effort. It's a good effort at something that's very difficult to capture and portray really well, because there were so many issues going on there, really.
And I think it's funny when you think about, like, because obviously we reviewed The Interview, which was a short film, we're going to review a short in a minute, that when someone makes the leap to doing a feature film, there's this sense of like, oh, okay, well, how are you going to fill a feature film? But actually, I think the opposite is the situation, which is, how are you going to condense it to a feature that actually is worthwhile? Because actually, you could film lots and lots of stuff, but is it good enough for the film? And is it supporting the narrative? Because with Golden Stripes, I found that there was a lot of stuff which was unnecessary, but there wasn't enough stuff which we needed.
Yeah, exactly.
And
it
was kind of, oh, okay, the acting was okay across the board. I thought Tyrone was very good. I thought he was strong. But some of the actors, okay, I'm not sure you're quite holding this up that well. Mm. And then, yeah, like I said, I just felt that we were given lots and lots of threads that didn't all get tied up, certainly not in any meaningful way, that I wanted more clarity there. So, like I say, ambitious and dealing with a lot of really heavy stuff. And there are some very standout scenes. The bit where they are protesting, I thought that was very good. This is powerful.
Yeah, powerful.
But there are lots of other stuff which I don't think was as good as that. So, yeah, I believe it's due in cinemas soon. I think it's having I think a limited release. I might be wrong, but saying on October 6th. So people actually can go and see this in cinema. Yeah. I think, you know, I'm all for supporting independent filmmakers, and it's very difficult to make and release a feature film. So do check out Golden Stripes and let us know what you think. Mm. And it'd be great to hear some feedback, you know, some reviews of that from people that have also seen it. On to our final indie film. This is a short called Groomed, from director Angelo Reyes. And again, we are dealing with some heavy themes today. This is to do with human trafficking, in which it's a more of a subtle situation that a character could find themselves in. And I think the film is trying to raise awareness that actually human trafficking happens everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful film.
Yeah.
We see a character living originally at home with her mum, but her mum's a bit kind of not on the same wavelength, shall we say, but she has her own problems. And the girl falls in with an older man. She's 16, he's 30, I believe, or at least that's how old he says he is.
Yeah.
At first, he treats her really well, takes her like to this fancy hotel and stuff like that. And lo and behold, we find that actually he has brought her into his network of prostitutes. And she didn't realize that was what was going to happen to her. And now she's being forced to have sex and do things with some of his friends, because at first he sort of says it's his friends that are going to be paying and he just needs to get the money. But then it becomes actually clear that this is his business plan and this is how he operates. Mm. This is a 20-minute film, and it goes through about 2 years of this girl's life. It jumps forward at one point to see her sort of further down the line. We've used the word a lot in this episode. I'm going to use it again, which is ambitious, because you can't approach a story like this without some trepidation about, you know, doing it justice. But I found it very powerful, very effective. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, I thought it was very good. In some ways, it feels a bit like a public information film.
Yeah.
That's very well contained, that sets down the classic scenario for human trafficking, how it can happen, where a young girl has, you know, she lives with her mum, not exactly estranged, but they lack real contact with each other. And it shows how she can get sucked in, shows how someone can be targeted because they're vulnerable, and then they make them dependent. So it's that kind of gradual progression within that scenario that's very clearly done. And it, as I say, with the opening and closing titles and the captions they put on, it gives it the feel of a public information film. And that makes it more effective because it's approached in that way. As you say, that kind of subject matter isn't easy to put into a 20-minute film, but they've done it just as a series of signposts and say, look, this is what can happen. This is someone who might be vulnerable. This is someone that could be taken in. This is the kind of person that might be coercive and controlling. And it's all about power. It's all about making somebody dependent on someone else. And they get the message across very well. Again, not a pleasant watch, but it does its job.
No, but I think it's coherent in what it's doing. Yeah. And you know, it breaks it even into these little chapters, and it has these headings about what's going on. And I felt that it was a well-structured film because they knew, look, we've got to get this across, and they're doing it with this character, but not... They know they can't go into too much detail. Like, you're giving a few scenes, but not... They're not giving everything, and it's more about the... how it could start from, like, which is like her broken home, I guess, how it could easily, you know, fall into this dangerous situation. And then obviously later on, spoilers, but you're given how she could potentially get out of that through the sort of chance encounter with a police officer. But they knew that they were doing this in a way that's like, look, it's got to be contained. It's got to work as a short film, because to try and go into loads more detail would have just left us all feeling very sort of unsatisfied. Whereas actually, I think they do really well with what they've given. It is powerful and it is affecting. I found it quite sort of traumatic at times. Weirdly enough, actually, so Ricardo, the character who grooms her, is the director.
And Reiser as well.
Co-writer, with Mary J. Dixon. Yeah. Yes, Angela Reyes. And yeah, brilliant performance, very believable. This sort of suave, charming guy at the beginning, turning into a bit more of a monster later on. It's done quite neatly. But also the character, I can't remember her name, but who plays his sort of like lieutenant, or the girl who keeps all the girls in line.
Keeps her in line, yeah.
Yeah, she was really sort of formidable. Who she happens to run into like earlier on in the film, I think. I thought it could work as an expanded piece. I'd be very happy to watch a feature length if they were to go into more detail about these characters. But as a short, it also really works, which is good.
I think so. I think it's very, very good, very well done. And shows what you can do with a limited amount of screen time. Again, it's that sense of economy, isn't it? Being able to use the time properly. But as I say, the way it comes across, it tells a very human story of what can happen and how it's real. This is not a fantasy. It is going on. It does happen. But what I think is interesting is that the girl that was involved didn't necessarily come from a broken home. It was two people who just had no emotional contact with each other anymore. But it wasn't necessarily a broken home. Not the classic scenario that would force someone out onto the streets as a drifter that might be vulnerable to being picked up by human traffickers. So it didn't take the obvious route at the beginning, which I think is a smart move as well.
Fantastic. That's Groomed, a short film. It does have a website, but there's a technical issue on the site right now. So I'll just direct people. There's a Film Freeway page for it. So filmfreeway.com/groomed-short-film, which you should be able to at least watch the trailer and things on there. There is a link to the website there, but when I've tried to get on it, it doesn't actually work for me. So yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. It says 2018 that it came out, so I'd be surprised if it's not available to watch somewhere. But yeah, feel free to let us know what you think if you watch it.
Absolutely.
Heading back in time now, in two ways, really. We're heading back to 86 for our nostalgia pick film, Stand By Me, Rob Reiner, which is in itself a throwback.
Yeah.
Because it's one of these films that then looks back in the past. So,
Had
you seen this before, Brian?
I saw it when it first came out, but I can honestly tell you I've not seen it since then.
This keeps happening. I keep doing this to you. I keep giving you films you saw when it came out, and that's it.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why, because it's a wonderful film.
It's terrific, isn't it?
Lovely film.
Weirdly enough, this actually was one that I hadn't seen that many times. I think I've seen it twice when I was a kid. And it was sort of film that my brother would put on because he's a bit older than me and he would sort of be more into these sort of films. But it had that quintessential summer holiday vibe of, you know, the kids out messing around, you know, being in the woods. But with Stand By Me, unlike a lot of other sort of films that are that kind of coming of age thing, this is actually dealing with some very heavy themes at the same time, but doing it in a way that you wouldn't really notice them if you were watching this as a kid. Like, you wouldn't necessarily pick it up. But if you haven't seen it, it was on Netflix, wasn't it? Did we watch it on Netflix? I think it was Netflix. It's essentially about these four boys, and there's been a boy who's gone missing in the area, and these four lads' friends overhear that someone has found the body. They decide to lie to their parents about staying over each other's houses so that they can make the very long trek to where this body potentially is, because they must see it. And it's set in the, what were we saying, 50s, 60s?
Late 50s.
And the music is very brilliantly chosen.
I love the music. It's wonderful.
And essentially is this sort of road trip, but without the cars. They're following the train tracks to this, but they get into all sorts of trouble on the way. Meanwhile, a very young Kiefer Sutherland and his gang of ne'er-do-wells are terrorizing the local neighborhood and potentially going to come across these boys as well. It's that sort of film that works completely because it gets the tone all right, and it captures, I think, a real enduring theme about what it's like being a child, you know, when you're young and you just don't really think about the consequences of what you're doing, because going to see a dead body overnight is actually kind of like a good idea. You know, that's
when you're a kid, you have no fear necessarily because you're discovering things for the first time, aren't you? So you don't feel that sense of fear at all. So, yeah. I feel a cliche coming on, Chris.
Yeah.
Will you indulge me? They don't make films like this anymore. They don't. It's so gentle and reflective. They were the first things I wrote down when I was watching it. It feels almost pedestrian and so much better for it. We've become used to a completely different pace of film these days. Here, the story is allowed to breathe. But it doesn't feel slow, and that's a tribute to the director and the cast. I mean, I love Rob Reiner as a director. But these are the types of films you just don't see anymore. Not really. And look at the cast you've got as well. You know, Kiefer Sutherland, you've got John Cusack as well. You've got a cameo from Richard Dreyfuss, who's telling the story as an adult, and it's flashing back in time. The music's brilliant. What I was curious about, though, was how the four kids, how their careers were so different to each other, weren't they, really? I mean, you would have the feeling that River Phoenix was always going to be the biggest star out of the four, but tragically had the shortest career of the four of them, really.
Yeah, obviously it was a sanity died. You got Will Wheaton, he's been pretty famous since.
More in TV though, isn't he? I think Will
Wheaton. I know him mainly from The Big Bang Theory, but I know that he's been in lots of other things. I think he's like the writer of a lot of things, isn't he?
Yeah, Corey Feldman.
Yeah.
And Jerry O'Connor played Vern, I think. Yeah. So you know, it seems in this film more the supporting actors became bigger. I mean, River Phoenix was 23 when he died. It's crazy, isn't it? What a waste of life and a waste of talent.
Like you say, you got like the talent with the boys. Then you got like Kiefer Sutherland and also John Cusack is like Denny. He's the main character. Well, I say main character, but his brother has died previously, and that's really affected his relationship with his parents, especially his dad. And that's a really powerful subplot. But again, it doesn't feel like it's giving you like a smack around the face the whole time. It very much is like giving you an understanding of this boy's childhood. And also, the film as a whole, I think, is about this journey for... so it's Gordy, isn't it? Is it Gordy?
Gordy, yeah.
The main character. That he is getting... He's obsessed with finding this body, more so than the others. I think they're sort of coming along for the ride. But Gordy's very obsessed. I think it's to do with, obviously, the grieving for his brother and where he finds himself now as this, like, lone child with... especially a father who doesn't seem to like him. They even he goes into a store at one point, and the store owner like knew his brother because his brother was quite good at baseball or something. And yeah, I think there is that depth to the film. So watching it as an adult, there's lots and lots about the film, which is really impressive. But actually, it's the sort of film you could watch. Again, we're going to get into cliches, but it's, it appeals to all ages really, because it's about childhood, it's about all these things. And I think there's some things in there I think that probably are not that that appropriate as a 15, but I actually think that it's got a lot of universal themes to it, and it's it's really, really good.
And it helped to turn the song Stand By Me into a number one hit in the UK by Benny King. And that to me is the icing on the cake, you know, that it features some, a great soundtrack anyway, but it turns Stand By Me into a number one hit. And that's really seals it. It's just a great film. And it's the type of filmmaking that I think we really miss today. Really, it's great. Love it. Another good pick, Chris.
Well, I do try. Well, actually, I have my brother to thank. He's the one who picked all these films. Bless him.
There you go.
There was one bit, there's a couple of bits in the film which do make me laugh, though, that because the whole thing is them following this train track. And there's one bit where one of the characters plays chicken with the with the train. And the train does have a very long time to see this boy, but at no point does he even try to apply the brakes. You don't hear any screeching of the thing.
They seem to be going very slow, those trains, though, didn't they?
Yeah.
That was almost like walking pace, really.
But then there was another bit where they then cross this bridge and they actually can't go back. They're actually stuck. They have to either go forward or jump off. But again... the train driver just doesn't put the brakes on. And I think it's indicative of a time when actually in the 50s, the train driver would have been well within his rights to just run them over. And I think he would just gone, what happened today, Garrett? Yeah, I killed four kids, but it's fine.
It's a different perspective on life. All films, whenever a film's made, you know, it does reflect the era that it was made in. All right, this was made in 86, but it's trying to portray an earlier time, and it somehow it does seem like there was a different attitude to life back then. That's what's so fascinating about comparing different eras, and we can do that very easily with films, can't we? That how well does it capture a particular era? And this film, I suspect, does it very well. Does it really well? I'd say what I did like was the when they're sitting around the campfire and they're having these conversations that kids have, you know, the conversation about Pluto, you know, what is Pluto supposed to be? You know, Mickey's a mouse, you know. It was the other character they were talking about. Well, you know the scene I'm talking about.
Yeah, Donald's a duck or something like that.
Donald's a duck, you know. Yeah. But what's good, you know, what is Pluto? What is Pluto supposed to be? And it's the sort of thing you do question when you're a kid. You think, what is that thing supposed to be? You know, and so it evokes your own childhood. You know, I'm not saying that we all went off to find a dead body necessarily when we were kids, but it's just that spirit of adventure, that sense of innocence when you're not grown up enough to appreciate the gravity of life. You don't have the maturity. You don't have any of the emotional or the financial problems that you have when you're an adult. You know, that's what it's evoking.
And it is absolutely brilliant. So do check it out on Netflix or wherever you get it, your films, because I think it is also available on Amazon. But you know,
yes, Netflix is the one though. Convenient
and easy. But that is the lot for this epic UK Film Club episode, because we've gone through a lot. Lots of films there, lots of choice and lots of things for people to check out. And thank you to everyone who's been listening this far, but most importantly, to our one Guatemalan listener and our 11 Chilean listeners.
And our 11 Chileans. Yeah, don't forget the 11 Chileans.
Those people mean more to us than the world. So thank you to everyone out there that is listening. Do share your thoughts with us on our socials at UK Film Review. It's always nice to hear people are listening and tuning in. And also, if you would do us an absolute lovely favour and review the podcast, particularly on Spotify, it means a lot to us and it helps us get out to more. Because who knows, if we got out to more people, we might have 2 Guatemalan listeners. That would be really something.
We might get somebody from Costa Rica or,
we may do.
Or Honduras or somewhere.
We do.
Or the Falklands, you know.
Falklands. We may already have these people.
I was going to say, maybe we already have.
Do you know, we have 7 Vietnamese listeners, so we're doing fabulously.
That is so cool.
We're doing fabulously. And thank you to everyone, because it's not just the UK, we are global. We are global.
We've proved it, haven't we, now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you to the filmmakers who specifically sent their films in for us to review. Please, everyone, do go check out those filmmakers and their films. Follow them on their socials, because it's really great to just see what they're up to and when these films come out, and you can watch them and see whether or not you agree with me and Brian or the critics on the website if they reviewed them too. But again, yeah, thank you to everyone for listening. This has been the UK Film Review Podcast with me and Brian.
Bye for now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.